You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 4th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, how's your bacterial cloud doing tonight?
Very fluffy.
Floating,
very fluffy.
Always floating aimlessly.
Like Pigpen.
So, Steve, I was thinking, for these Star Wars movie extravaganza viewing party that we're organizing.
Yes.
And for those of you who have not heard about this, we are organizing a viewing party for the new Star Wars movie. Yeah, so we're actually getting a large group of friends and family of the SGU, and we're auctioning off a couple of seats to join us for all-day party where we're going to go see the Star Wars movie, and then we're going to go back to the SGU studio. We're going to record a one-hour review of the movie and then have a party for the rest of the night.
Yeah.
And we did get some bids in, which was very nice. So if you're interested, you just send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. In the subject, have it say Star Wars tickets, and you can put in a silent bid, and you'll be receiving two tickets to go see the movie.
If you win.
Right. If you win.
If you win,
you'll get two tickets to come see the movie with us. You have to take care of your own airfare and hotel, if applicable. And you'll also be spending the whole day with us. And we'll be doing this on December 19th. The movie starts around 12:30 p.m. It's a matinee. You know, showing up around 11 a.m. would be the right time to do it. So that being said, I put it to all of you. We should wear costumes.
Should we?
I'd like to.
What kind of costumes?
Do we go all out, or do we just have a subtle, like, just the... you know, just the buns on a head or
I want you all
vest.
To dress as Leia. Can you all dress as Leia?
All different versions of Leia, I would do that.
All five of us in the Jabba costume. I'll run the tail. Oh,
yeah. I'll be Salacious Crumb.
Yeah, only if you can do the laugh.
No, I definitely want to do something Luke Skywalker.
Could it be Farm Boy Luke or Jedi Luke?
I don't know. Jedi Luke is a little too 80s for me. I don't have the hair.
It's a little 80s and can't act.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's too 80s, really?
I don't think it's that 80s.
With the flip over gray inside, that's so 80s.
Yeah.
When he opens up the, yeah.
Did wonders for the Star Trek crew. And
yeah, right.
Wrath of
exactly,
Khan.
Exactly.
Oh, did you guys see that there's going to be a new Star Trek?
Yes, we
did.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
MG.
Yeah,
I'm
I think
excited.
That's going to be pretty awesome. Why not? Well, of course.
I'm excited.
It's time for another series, but they're talking, what, 2017?
Yeah, it's not going to be for a while.
Way too that's much not time. Too
I just hope they do something a little innovative with it, you know?
I think they will. I think they'll have to be forward-thinking. A bunch of my friends that go to Caltech or recently finished at Caltech and or work at JPL are often involved in Caltech community theater, and their next production is going to be the Star Trek musical.
Oh, boy. Wow.
Okay.
It's called Boldly Go. I'm so excited. I love my nerdy friends.
I will boldly go where no one has gone before.
All right, well, Bob, tell us about this week's Forgotten Superhero of Science.
Yes, for this week in Superhero of Science, I'm going to cover Andrea Ghez, who is an astronomer and UCLA professor. She was voted one of the top 20 scientists in the U.S. and studies stellar motions near the Milky Way's supermassive black hole. I guess it was one of those kids that was just so cool. She would stay up late at night and look at the stars and think very profound questions like what is the beginning and ending of time? What is where's the edge of the universe? And how do you come to terms with humanity's insignificant 100,000-year-old existence when being faced with a universe that's 13 billion years old? Great questions for anybody to think of, really. But when a kid thinks about stuff like that, I just love it. And I guess she never really stopped thinking about it because now she is a world-class observational astrophysicist and professor of astronomy at UCLA. Now, as I mentioned, Ghez was voted by Discover Magazine as one of the top 20 scientists in the U.S. who's shown a high degree of understanding in their fields. And she's got just a fantastic job. She studies what is arguably one of the most fascinating areas of space within millions of light years. Guys?
The galactic core?
Yes, the center of our galaxy, which houses our very own supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A star.
And according to Star Trek, that's where God lives.
Oh, that's right. Almost forgot that. Painful memory. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
And she works at the famous Twin Keck Telescopes, which are at her disposal in Hawaii. They use adaptive optics, which is so cool. And that gives her the best view of that area of space, probably more than anyone ever has. Using it, her and her team have discovered multiple stars orbiting close to our black hole, including what's called SO-102, which orbits the black hole in a record-breaking 11 years. The previous one was like 15 years and change. So this star has the shortest period of any star orbiting, and it orbits at 1% the speed of light.
That's fast for a star.
That's absolutely. And I mean, its cosmic year is 11 years, and our cosmic year is what?
Oh, it's like 250 million years or something?
Yep. A quarter billion years. Very good.
Quarter billion years.
So these measurements that her and her team make contribute to what is now the undeniable evidence that supermassive black holes do indeed exist, and that ours has a mass of about 4 million solar masses.
Whoa.
So
that's massive.
Fascinating research, fascinating woman. So remember Andrea Ghez, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing stellar velocity dispersion of a galactic bulge.
Galactic bulges are cool. I can't help. This is one of those irrational things that I cannot purge from my brain. I could never help being a little scared of really massive black holes. You know what I mean? There's just something scary about the idea of something that big with that much gravity, even though I know rationally I have nothing to be worried about.
You're silly. I mean, right? That's common belief, actually, that it's going to suck up everything. It's like, well, it's so far away that it's so irrelevant, how intense the gravity is. And you want to hear some really freaky shit when you're talking really supermassive black holes. If you were at the event horizon, you wouldn't really even necessarily notice it. The tidal forces are anywhere near what they would be at the event horizon of a stellar mass black hole. And how about this? Their average density could be less than water.
Mm-hmm. Oh, crazy.
Really? I mean, yeah, this is kind of counterintuitive, but that's what the math says.
So you can get close to the event horizon and not get drawn in? You can go up to the edge?
Well, I mean, the gravitational pull could be intense, but the tidal forces wouldn't necessarily be intense, because you've heard of spaghettification, where the tug on your feet could be thousands or millions of times greater than your head, which kind of turns you into spaghetti. That you wouldn't see those types of tidal forces until you got very close, well within the event horizon. But yeah, the gravity would be intense, but you wouldn't be ripped into spaghetti. Probably just accelerated in very fast.
Yeah, but you wouldn't be able to escape. Yeah, once you get to the event horizon. All right, Kara, tell us about the power of poop.
Yep, another week, another poop story.
More shit.
You guys might like that.
That's <yeah. laughs>
This is becoming a little subspecialty of yours.
I know.
You are our resident poop expert.
Yes, I honor that. Okay, so will the future be fueled by fecal matter? That's the big question.
Shit, yeah.
And it... Yes, I love it. It is a question that was posed this week in a report that was released from the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health, which is a joint action with Canada. And they proposed this vision for the future, which is in line with their recent Agenda 2030 for Sustainable Development, that has a goal of reducing half of the proportion of untreated wastewater in the world. So they're really focused on sanitation lately, and for good reason. Did you know that? One, as much as 90% of wastewater that is produced across the world is just discharged into water untreated.
Blah.
Rivers, lakes, oceans.
What?
That's disgusting.
And nearly 1 billion people simply defecate out in the open. They don't use toilets. That is
how many?
Just nearly 1 billion. So that's just under 1 out of every 7 people on the planet.
I mean,
Kara,
are they just doing it like in rivers and...
Yes, or
like
in
that.
or in the street.
Yeah. Oh no.
And so this is about 60% of those people do live in India. It's a massive problem in India.
The rest are in San Francisco
and LA. And about 2.4 billion people don't have access to proper sanitation. So now we're getting into massive proportions of the global population. So this UN report basically talks about the dual benefits that could come from using fecal matter as fuel. The first one is that it would help meet growing energy demands by using human waste as fuel. And the second one is actually even more powerful in that it would improve sanitation in these areas, especially where there's no active sewage management. So it describes the two ways that we can use human waste as fuel. First is through biogas, and the second is through fecal charcoal. So let's get into biogas first, because that's really what the main focus of the report is on. This is generated through anaerobic digestion of poop in these specialized containers that allow the poop to break down without the help of oxygen, and it produces approximately 60% methane by volume. And so in all these really fancy calculations that you can look at in this report, they say that if the people, only the people who openly defecate, so the people who don't use toilets across the planet, were targeted, there could be a benefit of biogas that it could be worth about $200 million annually in fuel costs, and it could meet the energy demands of around 10 million households. So if we only utilize the poop of this like 1 in 7 people, about 10 million households could have enough energy to power them for the year. If all the human waste on the planet were converted this way, so if there was a massive rethinking of what we do with human waste, it could value anywhere, and this is a large number because there's a lot of calculations into how much poo we actually produce, but between $1.6 and $9.5 billion annually, and it could meet the energy demands of 138 million households. So to put that in perspective, that is the number of households in Indonesia, plus the number of households in Brazil, plus the number of households in Ethiopia. So that's a lot of households that could be fueled by poop. And in addition, all the leftover slurry that's utilized during this biogas production process could be used to produce poo-poo charcoal. And the way that you do that is you just basically burn it in a big oven at like 500 degrees, and you end up with these little briquettes that were made out of poo. And that would produce about 47 million kilograms of poo-poo charcoal. And as a reference point, a household in Uganda uses 1 kilogram of charcoal a day in order to like fuel their house. So 47 million kilograms could obviously be very useful, especially in these developing nations.
Could you barbecue with it?
I would recommend against it.
Okay. That wasn't a no, Steve.
It gives it a nice mesquite flavor.
Exactly. Yes. I was going to say,
earthy.
You're the doctor. So I'm not sure what bacteria can live beyond 500 degrees Fahrenheit. Maybe you could barbecue with it.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But would you want to?
Would you want to?
And would you want to?
That's obviously a big question here, is the ick factor. It's the same thing when you hear about tap to toilet, you know, or toilet to tap, like water treatment to be able to purify and then eventually be able to drink it. But there is this new initiative now with this UN university in conjunction with the Ugandan Ministry of Water and Environment, along with a bunch of NGOs and academic partners. And what they're basically trying to do is utilize this technology to help rural growth centers and small towns in Uganda, but also high population density institutions like schools and prisons, start to utilize this fecal matter to energy transformation. And their hope is that this is self-financing within 2 years, that the energy savings that you get by putting the infrastructure in place actually pays for the infrastructure. And all of this, guys, is in advance of World Toilet Day. World Toilet Day is on November 19th. So think about that as you're out and about town on November 19th, that there are so many people on the planet who don't have access to proper sanitation. Again, around 2.5 billion people. And we can really be raising awareness about that.
I've always said that two of the most important inventions in the history of humankind has been toilets and toilet paper. No doubt about it.
Oh, it's huge. I mean, it actually makes a massive difference. I mean, think about infectious disease and how readily it can spread in untreated wastewater, how readily it can spread when there isn't proper sanitation in place. If people are using the street as a latrine, if people are, you know, going in local rivers and then they're drinking that water, they're washing their clothes with that water, or it somehow is ending up in their supply, you see cholera outbreaks. I mean, you see all sorts of outbreaks of disease. And we know that children across the globe die of like diarrheal diseases a lot. And so this is something that I think that we can all think about. We have the luxury here in the West of everyone having a toilet. I have multiple toilets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. As do I. How about when we have to colonize places like the moon? I wouldn't be surprised if something like that were necessary for moon exploration.
Well, everything. You're going to want to use everything. You'll recycle 100% of all stuff, you know, in any kind of space environment like that.
And really, it does seem like the power of poop rivals natural gas. The biogas that can come out of this poop fermentation process really can rival natural gas.
But
in many
isn't it natural gas though?
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, it is natural gas.
All right, just try to get a little technical here. Okay.
All right, Evan.
Yes.
Some crazy physicist thinks he discovered an actual parallel universe, maybe.
Crazy? I don't know. I don't think he's that crazy.
Well, tell us. Convince me there are parallel universes.
Well, this comes to us courtesy of NewScientist.com, which the headline reads, "Mystery Bright Spots Could Be the First Glimpse of Another Universe." So, we have data from the European Space Agency's Planck telescope that may have revealed the first evidence of another universe. At least that's the analysis by Ranga Ramchari, who is a researcher at Planck's U.S. data center in California. Let me take you back for a quick, brief history of time. 13.7 billion years ago, when there was nothing, and suddenly all the matter in the universe exploded on the scene in a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a second, and scientists refer to this as the Big Bang, which is the part of the larger encompassing Big Bang theory. Now, the Big Bang theory predicts that the universe was a very hot place and that as it expands, the gas within it cools. Thus, the universe should be filled with radiation that is literally the remnant heat left over from the Big Bang, and we call that cosmic microwave background, or CMB. So Dr. Chari had been studying the CMB, and he stumbled upon something rather odd. While mapping the CMB using the Planck telescope, he found a mysterious glow. Here's what he did to find it. He took everything from the CMB and he removed the stars and the gas and the dust and everything else that's out there. And at the end of this, he should have found nothing except noise. Nothing but noise, flat everywhere. But that wasn't the case.
Well,
instead,
Evan, the first thing he took away, did I miss it? The first thing he took away was actually the cosmic microwave background radiation itself. He made a model of that radiation and subtracted that. Then he took away the stars, gas, and dust, and nothing should have been there except you're right, except noise.
He found in a specific frequency in patches of the sky, some of them looked brighter than they should have. And they appear to have come from just a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. And this is when the first light was being emitted, when the electrons and protons of the early universe were combining. And these spots of light that he discovered were 4,500 times brighter than they should have been. So what are the bright spots? Well, the possibility was raised by Dr. Chari that this could possibly be evidence of another universe or universes bumping up against ours, or in effect sort of bruising our own universe.
Yeah, if the multiverse, basically a bunch of bubble universes and adjacent bubble universes, whatever that means. Yeah, it's one model of a multiverse. So that's interesting. Yeah, that it could leave some slight trace on our universe. But, you know, it's obviously very early to draw any conclusions about this kind of data.
What did it actually look like, the trace?
Bright spots.
Just bright spots, but they weren't in the shape of a circle?
No description as far as the shape of the spots.
Like against
only,
the CMB?
Only the intensity.
We did a recent science salon here in LA where we were talking to some like heavy hitter CMB folks, and we were asking if we could discover the multiverse, what would you look for? And they all said, I would look for a circular pattern in the CMB.
Wow.
That is what, like another universe colliding with our universe would almost always leave a circle. Because because they said, you know, via conservation of energy, universes we think of as all being spherical because that's the least, you know, it's the most conserved shape.
Obviously, though, not everyone's convinced about this possibility. For example, astrophysicist David Spergel from Princeton University says that the dust properties are more complicated than we've been assuming, and perhaps that's a more plausible explanation as to the brighter spots that we're seeing.
See Bicep 2.
Yes,
Bicep
exactly.
2, 2014. They were using the telescope at the South Pole, and they announced a faint signal with earth-shaking cosmological implications. There were spirals of polarized light spotted in the cosmic background. And it turned out, though, upon further observation, it was, in fact, dust of grains within our own galaxy. So very, very local phenomenon going on there. Some people believe that it's just completely implausible, such as Joseph Silk of Johns Hopkins University. He thinks that the paper that Dr. Chara wrote is a good analysis of anomalies in Planck data. He says, my view is that they are almost certainly due to foregrounds, essentially saying not possible at all. And yeah, there is a high burden of proof to establish this, and more research must be done.
What's his name? Is it Chary? Chary?
Uh-huh.
Even he says that there's a 30% chance that what he saw wasn't evidence of anything really at all, and it could just be normal fluctuation. So even he would admit that. But of course, if 30% is just normal fluctuations, then the 70%, you know, what would that be? Some of it, of course, with embedded within there, you assume it could be evidence for another universe, but also there could be evidence right. of just some other physical process that we're not aware of. That could have, so that as well. So sure, I think this is something that is, to me, incredibly fascinating in that this, as far as I'm aware, this is the best potential evidence for alternate universes that actually is in alignment with some theories. In this case, it's certain modern cosmological theories. And that's what makes it really exciting. But yeah, we've got a long haul ahead of us to tick off all the other checkboxes on that list before we could really seriously consider that. And the big downside is that, especially with the Planck data, there's really just not a hell of a lot there that we could use to really definitively say one way or the other, or to prove that this really is evidence of an alternate universe. So that's, you know, the classic thing that's so frustrating is that we may never be able to get evidence of that. And we may never, you know, get any more confident than we are right now, possibly. But it's so fascinating because like finding intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, having evidence of another bubble universe would be such an amazing Nobel Prize winning, unforgettable discovery that it's just, you want to believe something like that so well. But like good scientists, you got to make sure that you approach it dispassionately and try to tick off those check boxes.
Yeah. With things at this level, it's an exhaustive process of ruling out other things, which happens often, especially with these big claims, right? The neutrinos going faster than light? Nope. Mm-hmm. The evidence for the inflation from BICEP 2 was plausible. Everyone pretty much accepted it, but nope. Turns out it was artifact. We talked the other week about the unusual light patterns from another star. Could that be alien? Sphere. Yeah, could that be an alien structure? Not holding my breath. It'd be nice, but we have to rule out all the natural causes first. And here, same thing. It's probably artifact. You know, it would have to survive a lot of attempts at disproving it before we would say maybe something new is going on here. So that's the process of science. But every now and then something survives this process and we get a really fascinating discovery.
But, there's just so many freaking questions. Like, is light traveling from one bubble universe to our universe? Like, is there a barrier? Is physics going to be the same?
Yeah, now you're getting crazy questions.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Bob, since we're talking about universes, I understand computer scientists are trying to simulate the entire universe in a computer program.
Yeah, this one's pretty cool. Scientists and engineers have created the largest simulation of the universe evolving, and they took it from its infancy to what would be the equivalent of modern day. And they did it partially to determine, how the visible universe actually arrived to its current state. This was created by the U.S. Department of Energy's Argonne National Laboratory. One reason they did it that a lot of people are claiming is that they did it to fill in a 13 billion year gap, essentially. By that, I mean that we've known for quite some time how the universe looks now from the many detailed sky surveys that we've done. I mean, not necessarily now, but, at least how the universe looked when that light left those stars. So we kind of know that. And we also know what the universe looked like soon after the Big Bang, according to the cosmic microwave background radiation that permeates everything. So we know those two things, but how did we get from point A to point B? And this is something that simulation can help with. So they ran the simulation, not on a desktop, of course, unless you wanted to wait many millennia for it to finish. They ran it on a Cray Titan supercomputer.
The Cray. Nice.
Which I haven't heard that in a while, huh, Bob?
Right. I mean, the Cray supercomputers were among the very first class of computers that were considered supercomputers. That's when they could do a few billion operations a second, and they were considered supercomputers. And then I didn't track it that closely, but then you didn't really hear about Cray. But this Titan supercomputer, which is an epic name for a supercomputer. Titan is fantastic. This was actually the fastest supercomputer on the planet in 2012, 17.5 petaflops. That thing was, it's not the fastest anymore. God damn it. Yeah.
Petaflops.
Quadrillions of operations per second.
Yeah, Kara, Bob's a pedophile.
Oh, my God.
Did you say jillions?
Quadrillion.
I don't think jillion is a number. Okay.
Quadrillion?
Quadrillion.
Quadrillion. Kablillion.
So, I like how you just said that so nonchalantly, though. Petaflops.
Oh, yeah.
Petaflops.
We've talked about petaflops for quite a while now, yeah.
Petaflops and yottabytes.
Yeah. I've heard of a yottabyte. I guess I don't know what a flop is.
Flowing.
Yeah, because yacht, I know what a byte is, and I know yada is like zepto. Like, it's just a prefix. But what's a flop?
It's a floating point operation per second. So that's how they designate how many calculations per second in it does. So that's a common term. Okay.
Yeah, so it's not a measure of memory. It's a measure of
speed.
Calculations.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Of processor
right.
speed. Yeah.
Now, for me, the best thing about this, one of the best things, was the name that they gave the simulation. They call it the Q Continuum, which is great. Certainly, there's some Star Trek Next Gen fans in that laboratory.
Go figure.
That's a fantastic name, right?
So, who'd have thunk?
So now the real defining characteristic of this was the size of it. What they did was it covers a cube. Imagine a cube that's 12.5 billion light years across, which is the biggest that's ever been attempted. Now, that cube, of course, was subdivided into smaller 500-byte subcubes, or I like to call them pixel cubes. So they had 180 billion of them. So based on those two numbers that I read, I came up with that each of these subcubes had to be 1/700th of a light year across, which is about 408 billion miles, which is 131 times the distance to Pluto. So each little subcube was 131 times the distance to Pluto. So that's pretty granular. Even though that's a big chunk of space, it's nothing compared to 12.5 billion light years across. So that's incredibly granular. And they coded into the simulation, as you would imagine, those physical processes that you would need to see the evolution of the visible universe, like matter that accretes into stars and the life cycles of the stars and the black hole interactions with the galaxies. And I saw some screenshots from the simulation, and you could see how the distribution of matter starts off fairly uniformly, and then gravity starts aggregating the dark matter, and within those clumps of dark matter, you start having galaxies and even planets forming, and it really ends up looking like a lot of images I've seen of the universe at the largest scale. It's really amazing. The other cool thing is that not only can we gain insight into the evolution of the universe, but we could also now compare this new synthetic survey of the sky to the large physical surveys of the sky that our instruments have already taken over the years. So up until this point, the simulations have been way too small to do a direct comparison like this. So once we start doing these comparisons, then we could really see, you know, we could potentially see things in the synthetic surveys that we just can't quite see it in the actual ones. And we could discover all sorts of new different things that are happening out there that we just don't have a clue of yet. But it could take a little while to go through some of the data because they've created, let's see, about, I think 2.5 petabytes of data that the simulation created that they've got to go through. But some people are calling this a new era of astronomy, being able to create such gargantuan synthetic surveys of the universe. So I think it's going to be a very, very fun ride.
Yeah, this is an interesting approach and goes beyond cosmology, of course, where you use a very robust computer simulation of a complex system. And of course, you're plugging in all of our knowledge about how that system operates. Then you compare the result to reality, and that tells you about our knowledge of the system. So we could do that for cosmology. We could do that for weather. We could do that for the brain, right? We could build a computer simulation of a brain. See, is it doing what our observations of the real brain are doing? If not, what's different? You know, what's missing from our simulation? And that's a way of testing, essentially, our models of reality. It's really cool. So you have these parallel research programs going on side by side, simulating something in computer and exploring the real life version of it to feed into the computer. And then the knowledge from the computer simulation feeds back into our exploration of reality. And they just keep going, so it's awesome. All right. One more news item this week. Jay, this is really interesting. This is about trying to save the rhinoceros with 3D printers.
So, Steve, you know what ancient Chinese medicine is, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a huge industry. If anything, it's a growing industry. And this is why poachers risk their lives to collect rare animal parts like the rhino horn. Powdered rhino horn, in fact, is more expensive than gold. You know, it sells around $5,000 an ounce in a powdered form. It's U.S. dollars. An intact horn is worth somewhere around $100,000 U.S. So what can we do to help stop the poaching, right? These poachers are just going out and they're finding animals like rhinos that have body parts that they want. They cut the horns off. A lot of the rhinos don't survive after they do it. You know, I just always thought education would be the thing that would get people to stop doing it. Well, it's a good idea, but it's not working. It's not going to be fast enough to actually save animals like the rhinos. As an example, the northern white rhino, there's one male left. There's four females left.
Oh, my God.
So yep. Yeah. And there's other rhino species that are in really bad shape. All for, you know, virtually, from our perspective, no reason whatsoever. It's completely meaningless. It's just a fake industry. So in comes this awesome company from San Francisco called Pembient. And they're a biotech company. And the short thing here is they want to print rhino horns. They use keratin powder and rhino DNA as the raw material. And this is an absolutely incredible idea. They want to flood the Chinese and Vietnamese markets with their printed horns to bring down the price. And this would make the risk and effort involved of collecting the real thing just not worth it. You know, let's say you're a poacher that does this and, you know, you find out that it goes from $5,000 an ounce to $10 an ounce because the market has been utterly flooded with these printed rhino horns that can be used the exact same way as the real thing, virtually made of almost the exact thing as the real thing. Is it worth it?
But can they tell the difference?
Yes, I think the difference, you can tell the difference. And also, you know, it's not 100% identical from a chemical perspective, of course.
But I'm not sure if these dealers are doing chemical tests, are they?
No, I think when you get down to the, like, the store owner, they don't care. They just want something to sell. I mean, if the powdered rhino horn could be cut with a lot of things, just like any of these other things, you might not even be getting what they're telling you you're getting. So I don't think they really care. I think that there is also a high-end market, like people that are buying the horns themselves and things like that, that would be harder to get into. But a lot of people, when asked, that are currently purchasing these products, would you buy a lab grown version of this, or a fake but similar chemically version to this? And a lot of them say yes, that they don't even care. So
that, I'm really surprised by that, to be honest, because it seems like it flies in the face of, like, the quote unquote virtues of ancient Chinese medicine. That the idea there is that their mindset is that this comes from a rhinoceros.
Right. I don't disagree with that.
It doesn't come from a lab.
I was surprised to read that as well, Kara. But, you know, that's what they're saying. And I think that to a certain degree, these people could be the purchasers and not the end users that are saying things like this as well. So it's not crystal clear on who they asked. But in the end, I think we need to do things like this. I think these efforts are very important. I think we should try. And I think as the 3D printing technology gets better and better and we can get something that's closer and eventually indistinguishable from the real thing, great. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah. That would be huge, because then you've got the upper level. You know, I think of it in like a cartel kind of a structure. So you've got, you know, the narcos, the people that are selling the huge quantities of the drugs, all the way down to the street dealers. Yep. And so if you're at the place where, like, the narcos or like the horn dealers can't even tell the difference.
Yeah.
Well, then you're really going to be able to infiltrate the black market, and you're going to be able to drive that price down. My concern is that this is actually going to drive the price of rhino horn up, because they're going to be able to tell the difference between the real shit and the not real shit. Yeah. And that's actually going to cause a rift.
I'm not sure. I don't know if I agree with you, simply because, like I said, that the end consumer doesn't even really know what they're getting. They just believe whatever the store owner gives them.
I agree. No, I agree.
Especially because it's a powder at the end.
Yeah, at the end. My concern is that it's not the end. Yes, the end user is what's driving the market ultimately, the same way that the heroin addict on the street, you know, in Philadelphia or Los Angeles are what are driving the market ultimately. But the people that are making these kinds of decisions are the people that are much higher up the chain who will be seeing these things in full.
So I've looked into this. So this is a very interesting question. I tried to wrap my head around this. And unfortunately, after doing my research, I'm more confused. maybe there's an expert out there who can help straighten me out. But I think that it's just not known. So the question is, and this is an economic question ultimately, what is the effect on the market of either destroying contraband? And a lot of what was written about this is about elephant ivory, but it applies, I think, to rhino horns as well. Like, so if they publicly destroy a stockpile of elephant tusks, of elephant ivory, what effect does that have on the market?
Because that's what they do now, right?
Yeah, that's what they do. Yeah, so one theory is that it drives the price down by sending a signal that we are going to go after poachers. The other theory is that it drives the price up by making ivory scarcer, or even creating the perception that it's scarcer, even if it doesn't affect the reality of how much ivory is on the market. And that perception of scarcity drives up the price, which encourages poaching because there's more of an incentive. Now, the countries have also tried flooding the market with legal ivory, because you can obtain ivory legally. Elephants die, you know, and you can harvest their ivory without poaching them. And the bottom line is, what's interesting is that from my reading about this is that we just don't know. We don't have the data to know what the effect was on the market of flooding it with legal ivory, with publicly destroying ivory. And so there's really just disagreement based upon people's best guess without really being settled by data, partly because the illegal markets are obscure. So we don't really have a way of tracking them. You know, we don't have that. It's not like it's a legal market.
It's not like they're filing tax returns.
Yeah.
It's part of this process.
But it would be interesting to see like a controlled, it can never be fully controlled, but a study in like a rural village where you can kind of see where things are coming in and coming out and actually look at the effects in that village.
No, it's interesting. I do think that we need to make an effort to understand the economic effects of what we're doing to try to stem these. Now, like anything, you know, it's better. The best option would be to reduce demand. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to traditional Chinese medicine using rare animal parts for snake oil, I mean, come on. There's no downside to reducing demand. Yep. For tiger bones or rhino horn or bear gallbladder or whatever. These things should just be squashed. These markets, we need to get rid of them. It's all BS anyway.
Yeah, shark fin soup.
Shark fin, exactly.
Yeah.
Ivory's different because people are mainly buying ivory just as a, you know, a raw material for stuff. You know, they're not necessarily using it for snake oil. And it's been around for a long time. There's a lot of legal ivory out there. So it's a little bit more complicated. The question is, could we manage elephant populations and manage ivory supplies in such a way that there is a reasonable legal ivory trade that keeps the prices low, you know, and manages the poaching? But there's like no simple answer. And every time somebody proposes an answer, somebody says, that's not going to work. It's going to have the opposite effect of what you intend.
exactly what I did.
Yeah,
sorry,
we just we just don't have the data to know the answer. Yeah. So we need data. That's the bottom line. That was my conclusion. One more thing that people say is the concern with the flooding the market approach is that you actually increase the size of the market, and that actually has a negative effect on what you're trying to do.
Because right now there are people who don't do it because they have an ethical quandary with it.
Or because it's expensive.
Yeah.
You drive the price down, you make it available, the market expands massively, and then you have a bigger problem on your hands. And eventually the poachers catch up and start, you know what I mean? So anyway, there's no easy solution, unfortunately. This is a nice idea, but we need evidence-based, you know, approaches. We need to study. We can't just assume this will work. We need to study it. So sorry to take the wind out of the sails on that one. But
no, I get you. You're right.
It's a complicated
problem. I think it's worth at least testing, or let's say that they continue to print these and make them better. And then, like Kara was saying, they get to the point where they're indistinguishable, and then we could flood the market with something that they would never know the difference. And I'm fine with that.
I say we stigmatize demand and drive it out of existence.
Oh, well.
That would be my preference.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's not working as quickly as we would like for it to be.
I know.
Working.
We're making progress, but it needs to be. You're right. It just needs to be. There needs to be zero tolerance for rare animal snake oil.
Yeah. Yeah, you need to have allies within those industries. You need to have allies, yeah, you know, thinkers that are culturally understanding of what's going on, who can speak from within the culture, because it's not as effective when you're on the outside, mm-hmm, pounding on the walls.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses.
Guys, I have been so excited to join The Skeptic's Guide. I love what we get to do on the show. We get to delve really deep into topics that matter to us, topics about science, topics about knowledge, and then share them with the listeners. That is exactly what The Great Courses is about.
In particular, especially recently, we've enjoyed The Inexplicable Universe by Neil deGrasse Tyson.
The one thing I don't understand, he calls it The Inexplicable Universe, and then he explains it.
Well, there's things that are inexplicable about it. Yeah, but he also talks about string theory and quantum foam, black holes, you know.
The Great Courses are videos and audio lectures presented by top professors. They offer over 500 courses on many, many different subjects, including science, math, history, art, and many more. You can enjoy them in so many different formats, whether they're DVDs, digital streaming, you can download them.
And we have a special deal from The Great Courses for our listeners. Order from 8 of The Great Courses' best-selling series, including The Inexplicable Universe, at up to 80% off the original price.
80%?
Yes.
Evan, for a limited time, so you better order today, all right? Go to thegreatcourses.com/skeptics. That's thegreatcourses.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. So, guys, I broke one of the cardinal rules of skepticism this week.
We forgive you.
You didn't meticulously lick a Tootsie Roll down to the brown center.
No, I went to a church and debated creationists.
What?
Whoa, oh, you went to a church?
What yeah. the hell?
Holy crap. Tell me about
it. Are you okay?
That's what you're not supposed to do, but I, you know, what can I tell you? I like debates. Yeah, I was invited by the Calvary Fellowship for their, what they call their skeptics forum, you know, where they like to bring in a
what
skeptic.
They call their skeptics?
Yeah, to talk about, to challenge their beliefs. So everyone was super nice. This was Big Faith or Big Bang, and I was debating Hugh Ross and Faisal Rana from Reasons to Believe. So they are old world creationists, mm-hmm, who think that science proves that God made the universe, basically.
Wow.
Yeah, very interesting.
Science proves it. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very interesting. Again, they were very nice. I had a good time, actually. They videotaped the whole thing. And if you want to, I will have the link in the show notes. You could watch the video. It's hour and 45 minutes, hour 50 minutes. But let me give you just some highlights. So basically what they're doing is what I said during the talk. They're retconning the Bible. They're reinterpreting the Bible so that it makes it seem as if the Bible predicted what science has discovered, right? So, of course, you know, the Bible is huge. It's 66 books, lots of words. A lot of it is poetic or abstract, or there's a lot of, you know, a lot of literary forms, a lot of poetic license in there. So there's a lot of opportunities to interpret things the way that you need to interpret them in order to make it fit what we already know to be true. And then they say the Bible predicted that this is the way the universe is, and it turned out to be correct. Therefore, science is confirming the Bible. See how that works?
Yeah, nice.
Now let me tell you the one point that they made that I think is actually legitimate, and I wonder if you guys could guess it. What's one thing about the universe that the creation model, as they call it, requires that turned out to be true, even though it wasn't what scientists originally thought?
Oh, God.
They thought it was eternal.
Exactly. Right, Bob. Very good. That scientists, they thought that the universe was eternal and unchanging. And then we discovered it was actually expanding, which means it had to have a beginning. And so, I have to say that that's true. The universe did have a beginning. If it didn't have a beginning, that would have falsified creation, no question. Right. And so they got that one correct, that the universe had a beginning.
Okay, they got the broadest.
Exactly.
Evan,
the really, some of the broad things, you say, yeah, sure, that broad concept is consistent with what the Bible's referring to. So here's another one where it's like a psychic, you know, making these generalized statements that turn out to be hits. So there's a lot of counting the hits and forgetting the misses. He has a lot of cherry picking, a lot of retro dicting, and a lot of retconning, and counting vague hits as if they're spectacular. And they say that, like, it's spectacular that the Bible exactly predicted this precise thing. Really? So, okay. So, like, for example, the Genesis says that the planet was a void, right? And a wasteland. And they go, they do a lot of going back to the original Hebrew or whatever and saying that word really means wasteland. So the Bible said that the world originally, the ancient earth was a wasteland. And Dr. Ray.
Early earth, yeah.
Yeah, went to this long, you know, discussion about the scientific evidence that the early earth was a, of course it was a wasteland. What's the other option?
It had to. Isn't the wasteland the opposite of life?
Well, yeah, it had, but there had to be, the earth had to have no life at first. Of course it did, right? I mean, there's no, I don't know what the other option could possibly be.
Yeah, before there was life, there was no life.
Yeah, there was no life. It was a wasteland. It had to be. But he counts that as a spectacular hit. The Bible got correct. Or I said, yeah, but like, for example, no biblical scholar thought that the world was 4.5 billion years old before science figured that out. And he goes, and he said, yeah, but the Bible says, and they always can go to some passage somewhere. It says the world is ancient.
Broadest interpretation.
Yeah, yeah 6,000 could be ancient. We 6,000 could be ancient. Antiquity.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of credit for that. Yeah. That's the bottom line is, sure, it's not saying that it's quote-unquote ancient isn't inconsistent with 4.5 billion years, but you don't get any points for it because it's so vague. But to them, it's stunning confirmation.
Wow.
Dr. Ross's big thing is the anthropic principle, right? That was basically the essence of his talk. The universe is fine-tuned for life, which it is. So I made a couple of points that we've talked about on the show before. It's kind of a trivial statement. Because it has to be, because we're here. So
but I don't think it's fine-tuned for life. I think our planet is fine-tuned for our life, but we
no, that's the puddle analogy, right? The planet is not fine-tuned for us. The universe is not fine-tuned for us. We are fine-tuned for the planet, for the universe. The water fits into the hole. The hole was not made to hold the water. You know what I mean? We're the water.
But the vast majority of our universe is inhospitable to most life.
Yeah, of course, but at the same time, there could be billions of planets in our galaxy alone that could support life. And that's only considering life that we recognize, you know. There could be many places that life could be, things that we would consider extremophiles that, you know, we're not really even considering that as
But doesn't
a,
that
as
fly in the face
life.
Of biblical scholarship? Like, they don't believe in aliens, do they?
They don't. So, you know, not alien, not intelligent life.
Gotcha.
He thinks
if
we ever discovered intelligent life, that would falsify his position.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
So at least he's putting his nickel down. I'll give him credit for that. So although that's a pretty safe one because the chances of that happening anytime soon are pretty low. But if SETI picks up a signal from an alien technological civilization, then he's already on record as saying that would falsify his position. So good. Okay.
Okay.
Right, but that's what it would take, essentially. Life, you know, bacteria, sure, it could be bacteria all over the place, who cares? But Dr. Ross takes the anthropic principle really to extreme degree. I mean, he says, like, there can't be life in other galaxies. Like, only our galaxy has the condition for life, and only our solar system, and only our planet. I mean, he really, really takes it to a ridiculous degree. But
is that
he
from interpreting the Bible?
No, that's just, you know, his logic is, our existence is phenomenally improbable. The universe, it was quote unquote designed for us. Therefore, there must be a designer. And so you'll see. I mean, I deconstructed his argument entirely. And then he's one of these guys who's full of a lot of misinformation or a lot of very cherry picked, very carefully crafted information, you know? Mm-hmm. So for example, like, we're talking about retconning. It's like, well, the Bible says that pi is 3. Because he says the Christian Bible has zero errors. Zero errors in it.
No.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Like, so, okay.
Wow. That's extreme.
That's extreme. It's like, what about the fact that they say pi is 3? They were just rounding it down. So, okay,
oh
you know, but you think about it. They had to round it off somewhere, so why not round it to the integer? The thing is, in and of itself, you can see how each individual argument is not totally ridiculous, but that's the difference between, you know, making reasonable accommodations and special pleading. You know, when you keep having to do it over and over again in all these sorts of ways, then it becomes special pleading. He's doing it in thousands of ways. What about the fact that it says that it created the sun on the fourth day? It's like, well, he said that was the day that the atmosphere went from, you know, from opaque to transparent. So from the, it was written from the perspective of somebody on the surface, so you couldn't see the sun until the fourth day, but it was there.
Oh, God.
Oh, boy.
Wow. Wait, and they think the day is like 24 hours and all.
No, he's old Earth. He thinks the Earth is 4.5 billion years old.
Right.
But wait
okay,
a minute. So. Wait a minute. So Genesis was written from the perspective of a dude that was on the surface of the planet before dudes happened.
Yes.
I'm so confused.
Yeah, but I don't know this. Do they think that God told somebody all this?
Yeah. The inspired word of God. Yeah.
Yeah, but why would God be telling you through the perspective of a terrestrial
Whatever.
Being?
Whatever. Find some passage somewhere that he can interpret as saying that that's the perspective and that makes
even
it all
just
work.
That, this is why you are a more patient human being than I am. Because even just that claim, I would be like, can we talk about this for 5 hours? I'm so confused.
This is this is the equivalent of claiming that Jar Jar Binks was a Sith Lord. Right? You guys have read that article.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or that the blowing up the Death Star was an inside job, which I love. Yeah, that conspiracy.
I love that. Yeah, it's fun.
This is, you could take any story and retroactive continuity, right? You can reinterpret everything in a dedicated way that makes it all work because people are really good at that. We're very, mm-hmm. very good at rationalizing to make stuff because that's the cognitive dissonance theory, right? When things don't fit together, that causes cognitive dissonance. And then we have to resolve that cognitive dissonance by rationalizing it. And so we get really good at it. And he has essentially made a career out of resolving cognitive dissonance around the stuff in the Bible that either is self-contradictory or doesn't make sense.
Ugh. But why?
How did it go? What happened?
Whatever. We had a very lively discussion. You know, I'm sure he thinks he won. I think I won. Whatever. It was fun. Watch the video. You'll see how it went down.
And you had a live audience?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did they feel like you did?
I think everyone was there was one person who came up to me at the end that was kind of nasty, you know, like the arrogance of ignorance epitomized, you know?
Oh,
yeah. You know, the whole, if humans evolved from chimpanzees, why are there chimpanzees? Literally, that was the first question.
Is that what he pulled out?
But that was just, that was a random audience member. That was one of these guys. But there was also a few skeptics there because we announced it on the show a couple of weeks ago. So some of our listeners were there. So it was fine. Everyone was super nice. As I said, it was fine, except for that one person. Everyone else was very, very nice. So I have no problem debating with pleasant people who are willing to keep it on the facts and the logic. I especially love debating with people who I completely disagree with. Because it's always a good experience, always a learning experience, you know. And as long as you're nice, you know, as long as you just be patient and nice, you'll completely destroy their misconceptions about how nasty skeptics are. So it's kind of easy to win if your goal of in terms of winning is to just maybe shake up their preconceptions a little bit. All you got to do is be nice. And you'll,
all right, so the guy came up to you. What happened?
I tried to explain a little bit of evolution to them, and they just got more and more obnoxious.
Confused.
So I said, well, it's unfortunate that you're not interested in the science because it's actually quite interesting. And then I just went to talk to somebody else because it was clearly that conversation was over.
But that's very that's very classy of you.
Yeah, very smooth.
Uh-huh. Kara.
It is. I know. You know what? I talk to people about this all the time because, of course, when I'm podcasting, whether it's on this show or on my show, it's really common that I'm like, you know, I think it's important to respect people. We don't always have to respect their ideas, but we do have to respect them as human beings and try and empathize and blah, blah, blah. And I know it's much easier said than done. It's just hard.
It's hard. It's very difficult.
It's hard when you're faced with somebody where in the back of your head, you're like, you moron.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is it is a human being with feelings, and they got to the place where they are intellectually or cognitively because they had a path as well, and we don't fully understand their path. And the 3-second interaction that you have is not representative of all, you know, of their entire life. So I think it is important to always kind of just take a step back and breathe.
Yeah, but also they invited me into their venue.
Yep.
Yeah, sure. I think I feel obligated to be super polite. I didn't pull my punches. I was very firm. I fulfilled what they brought me there to do, which was to very passionately defend the skeptical position. But I did it with as much, you know, class and politeness as I could. And there's always going to be somebody who's going to try to goad you into getting upset and being mean, because then that's the justification mm-hmm. they're all really looking for. Right. And so, again, if you just resist that urge and stay professional, there's a certain victory in that alone. I did that on the Dr. Oz show. I beat Dr. Oz on his own show just by being pleasant. And he came off as kind of the jerk.
Dr. Oz.
Yep.
So anyway.
Exasperated thinking about Dr.
Oz. I know. Although apparently this season's going to be more about the science and less about the snake oil.
But great. Good job, Dr.
We'll
Oz.
See.
No way.
That's what he says.
I'll put money down on that.
That's what he says. Hey,
depends on how he defines science.
I'll always give people a chance for redemption. If he really wants to redeem himself, that would be awesome.
Oh, God.
But
he's got a lot
damage
of
– done, pal.
Not holding my
breath. A
lot of
redeeming.
No, Steve. Yeah.
How about apologizing redemption? For all the crap in the past?
Exactly,
Start
Evan.
With that.
He wants redemption? Sure. You can have redemption. Admit everything that you did.
I don't think he's going to go there.
But you can't slowly ease his show into a more scientific place and everyone's like, oh, yeah, great for Dr. Oz. No. Yeah, no, sorry. Well. Screw you for all the
Welcome
damage
back
that you
to
did.
The science fold.
Yeah.
Jerk.
Yeah, you guys shouldn't go to churches and debate creationists.
Probably not.
All right, Jay.
What?
Who's that noisy time?
Oh, boy. So who remembers last week?
I do. I was here.
It existed.
So last week, I played this noisy.
Hello, SGU listeners. This week's Who's That Noisy is tricky. What could it be?
What is it?
Yeah, it's a Vocaloid.
Yeah.
A synthetic voice simulator.
That is correct. How did you know?
Ding, ding, ding.
I went to a Vocaloid concert once. It was super weird.
So this particular one is from a website called Avona.
Okay.
And it's very, very interesting. Like, you know, they have a lot of different voices on there with different accents, and the technology is getting very good. We had a winner this week, and the Vocaloid wanted to say something. Vocaloid, would you mind telling us who this winner is this week?
Hello, Jay. I would be happy to. This week's winner is Tom Morgan, who guessed the answer correctly. He even gave my name, which happens to be Amy.
Good job, Tom Morgan. He guessed it all the way down to the name of the voice.
Wow.
Now,
impressive.
Can you choose the accent?
Yeah, you can choose the voices and the different, you know, different accents and everything.
But
absolutely.
Then that's a totally different character. Like, it wouldn't be Amy anymore. It would be a different person.
Oh, yeah, of course
person.
Not. It would be a different person, yeah. Different.
Because
different
it actually voice. Is a voice actor who, like, sits there and records every phoneme.
Gee whiz.
Yeah, it's like a big process.
Yeah, now, I had a lot of fun with this. I experimented with different sentence structures, and depending on if you type in, like, when I tried to get it to say its name, I wanted it to say it in a particular way. So if you just type the name in and it says its name, or if you type it in at the end of a sentence, it detects the shape or the form of the sentence and changes inflection, of course, because that's what makes it sound human. Mm-hmm. And they do a very good job with it. You know, it's free on the website as far as like sampling and all that. This listener that won actually uses these all the time, which I thought was interesting, and is quite familiar with them and probably, you know, with that voice and probably several others on the site. But what I also found interesting was there are – and now, Kara, you and I were chatting about this. There are people who use these voices to sing.
Yeah. That's really – when you think of Vocaloid, that's the main phenomenon is these musical Vocaloid programs, these speech synthesizer programs.
There's a medical application. You could record your own voice, basically create a Vocaloid of yourself. Like, let's say if you're at the beginning of a degenerative process like ALS, so that when you ultimately do lose your voice, you'll have a computer that could talk in your voice for you.
That is awesome.
Wow.
That's so cool.
All right. So thank you, Tom Morgan, for that. And here's this week's Who's That Noisy? What is it? Email me your answer or your guess, and also email me any cool noises that you stumble on to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Kara, what's the word this week?
The word this week is indolent. Anybody have a guess about indolent?
I know what it means because it's a medical term.
I don't know.
So it is a medical term, so that's a good cue. But the really interesting thing about indolent, and I really like it as compared to some of my favorite words we've done so far, like stochastic and canonical, because it means something different in the medical community than it means in its general use.
There's a lot of words like that.
Yes, and I love them, and I want to find as many as I can. So in general, when you hear the word indolent, the general definition, it's an adjective, and it means having or showing a disposition to avoid exertion, slothful, habitually lazy, procrastinating, resistant to physical labor. So like an indolent person is a lazy person.
Describing me.
But the medical definition seems to be completely unrelated, although it is not.
No, not really. It kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I didn't feel the connection right away until I started reading about the etymology. But the medical definition is causing little or no pain, inactive or relatively benign, like an indolent ulcer. It's not painful. It's slow to heal. So it's something that may be kind of happening in the background and the patient doesn't even realize they have this indolent infection or this indolent disease. And it's just a kind of a slow burn.
Yeah, the disease is sluggish and lazy.
There you go. The disease itself is sluggish and lazy. That's a good way to look at it. Yeah. And I never really thought about that because the big thing that you hear a lot is that indolent actually comes from this idea of causing little to no pain. So the person has an indolent infection or an indolent disease because they're unaware of it because they don't feel the symptoms of it. And so this is where things get interesting. If you look back to the 1660s from the late Latin indolentum, that translates to painless. And if you go even further back, indolence, the noun from 1600, means insensitivity to pain. From the Latin indolentia, freedom from pain, insensibility. So when you're like, okay, well, it really comes down to an insensitivity to pain or a freedom from pain. So that makes sense that indolent in a medical, you know, context is that they don't feel pain. What does that have to do with being lazy? Well, the sense of laziness happened around 1710, and it comes from the notion of avoiding trouble or not wanting to take pains to do something.
Wow, take pains.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So this was a very common expression, and that's where you start to see the crossover expression. So really, the etymology of this word does come from pain. And think about it, indolent, Spanish, dolor, dolor de cabeza.
That's right.
Like you hear that dolor over and over, but you don't take pains to do something, you are lazy.
Wow, that's
weird,
cool.
Right? Isn't that fun?
Yeah, that's why language is cool.
It's so fun.
It is.
But I've always, in a medical context, I've heard it used much more often to mean just a very slow process than without pain.
Yes. And I
think that's
a
more common
use. And I see that those two things probably have become sort of conflated because so often both of those things apply.
Yeah.
And so, but yes, I mean, when I was talking, the reason this came up is because I have a friend who's visiting me who is a newly minted doctor. And I was like, ooh, let's think of a fun what's the word this week together. And she was like, one of my favorite words is indolent. It's like such an interesting and very colorful adjective for a disease state.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it just means so much when you tell somebody that person has an indolent whatever.
Indolent tumor, indolent infection. Yeah.
Yes, or an indolent ulcer, you know, that they don't even know it's there. And that's really ultimately where that conflation came from, because it started with not feeling pain, but still having a disease. Very common with cancer.
Yep. It's true. Cool. All right, Jay, you haven't done a Swindler's List in a long time, but you got a cool one for this week. Tell us about it.
This week's Swindler's List is ransomware. Or you may have heard of an actual instance of it called the Crypto Locker. You guys know about this?
Yeah, this is terrible.
It is terrible. It sucks when you get hit with it. This is a growing scam, and almost anyone can fall prey to it. You have to be, of course, very careful when you're on the internet, particularly opening files. And this is, you know, a lot of ways that people get it is a file gets emailed to them, they open it up, and a Trojan gets installed. So people's PCs would get infected with these Trojans, and it come in, you know, say from an email attachment or other typical means. And what this little nasty bastard does is it encrypts whatever files the hacker wants it to on your computer or your computer's network. And that is a big deal. They used an RSA public key cryptography, which is a simple way to make it so the victim just can't undo the encryption. It said that the encryption is technologically impossible to break. And even if it isn't, which you could debate, it is absolutely impossible for you to decrypt it in the amount of time that these hackers and scam artists typically give you to do the thing that they want you to do, which is pay them a ransom. The victims will see a message on their machine telling them their files have been encrypted and they will be deleted or forever lost if a Bitcoin payment or other anonymous prepaid cash service is not made by some date. You know, give you a week. If you don't pay in a week, you know, their $1,000 ransom goes up to $2,000 and you have one more week. And then after that, they delete the unlocking key and your files are lost forever.
So why don't you just back up all your files in that week?
Well, no, you can't because once they're encrypted, they're gone. This is why you need to back up now.
Daily,
But keep this in mind, guys, and this is a mistake that I've seen people make many times. They take a backup and then let's say this encryption happens, right? Then their good backup gets overwritten by the encrypted backup because they don't even know that the files were encrypted. Now they don't actually have an active backup.
You need
to take
multiples.
A preserved backup, or multiple backups.
Like
by
Time Machine on the Mac actually does a daily backup until you hit a month, and then it like drops one from that month. It has a whole series so that you have multiple iterations of your same computer.
Yep,
which is very helpful.
So most of the hackers that do this actually unlock the files, right? Why? Because the word gets out, and if you pay them, you will get your money back. You go on the internet and you look this up, and you'll see that most people have a positive transaction experience, meaning that they pay the money and they do get their files back. Now, look, it's a business after all, right? It really is a big business. This is a phenomenally huge international business run by mob cartels. Like, this is huge.
Whoa.
This is huge globally. Ransomware was at the start, it was big in Russia. It's still very big in Russia, but over the past few years, it's grown, as I said, internationally. Check this out. In June of 2013, McAfee, which is a popular security software company, created a report, and they stated that there was over a quarter million, 250,000 unique samples of ransomware in the first quarter of 2013.
What?
And that number doubled from 2012.
Wow.
Yes. Wow. So I want everyone to think of it like this. First, you have to have very good virus protection on your computer at all times. You should be running scans regularly if they're not already cooked into your security software. You should have backups. You know, you should think of the moment you click that internet plug into your computer, that Cat5 cable that connects you to the outside world, that you are being hit thousands of times. People are trying to get at you nonstop. You know,
Bastards. You
just be very careful, guys. You know, don't open emails from people you
don't
know.
Don't click any link that somebody emails you.
Okay.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we're taking a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Squarespace.com.
So, guys, I use Squarespace and I am actually actively using it on a daily basis. It's so easy to log in. It's so easy to go into the back end of my website and move things around, look at all of my stats, and I know nothing about web design, but it makes me look like a pro.
You should use Squarespace simply because it looks great, it's easy to use, and it has all the tools you need. Look at Kara. I mean, I can't even believe.
Did you guys know that Squarespace has state-of-the-art technology that will be used to power your site to ensure security and stability?
And it starts at just $8 a month. And you're going to get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial today with no credit card required at squarespace.com. Make sure you use the offer code SGU to get 10% off your first purchase.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We had a sweep last week, but don't let that get you discouraged, guys. You could do better this week.
You bastard.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Buck up. You'll do fine. All right.
Whatever.
Here we go. Ready? Number one.
Mm-hmm.
An examination of the medications used by astronauts on long-duration missions aboard the ISS finds that the most common medications used are for anxiety. Item number two, a large survey of anti-vaccine websites finds that two-thirds of them use scientific studies to support their negative claims about vaccines, while one-third use anecdotes. I'll clarify for you guys up front that there may be overlap between those groups, right? So Some websites might use both. Some might use neither. Some might use one or the other.
These are two independent measures.
It turned out to be 2/3 and 1/3, but I don't want you to think like they're not exclusive, you know, groups. Anyway, item number three, a new study suggests that supervolcanoes, unlike regular volcanoes, do not erupt because of a buildup of pressure in their magma chambers and therefore require an external trigger. Evan, go first.
Okay. Astronauts on long-duration missions aboard the ISS. The most common medications used are for anxiety. What about aspirin? Don't they get headaches and things? But anxiety medication, I don't know. Maybe not. In any case, moving on to two, the survey, a large survey, in fact, anti-vaccine websites, 2/3 of them use scientific studies to support their negative claims. 1/3 use anecdotes. I don't know if that ratio is right. Do 1/3 use anecdotes? Well, you would think that they would feel more validated if they were able to use scientific studies. So I'm not surprised that that ratio is higher than the anecdotes one. But how extreme are we talking? I mean, we could be talking more like 90% of scientifics use scientific studies rather than 10% anecdotes. I don't know. I mean, these bastards are clever and they do try to use science to their advantage as best as they can. They'll do anything to promote their ideas. The last one, supervolcanoes. Unlike regular volcanoes, they do not erupt because of a buildup in pressure. They require an external trigger. So what could that be? Earthquakes? What other sort of external triggers? Continents shifting? These sorts of things, perhaps? Do not erupt because of a buildup in pressure. Yeah, all right. I kind of think that one's going to turn out to be science. I got to figure out, though, which the other two is the fiction. Now, the medications used for anxiety, they might be anxiety medications, but maybe they have other purposes as well, and therefore they're multi-purpose drugs, not just anxiety. They happen to be anxiety drugs, but maybe they do other things as well. If I go with that line of thinking, then all that leaves me is the anti-vaccine one being the fiction. I'll say the anti-vaccine one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
I don't know. I just don't see astronauts being anxious like that. I mean, I guess I could see how being in such a confined space, I guess, could get you a little antsy. Yeah, I guess I could kind of see that, especially for long duration. Okay. The anti-vaccine one. Yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense. Oh, wait, let me think about that. Negative claims. I have seen lots of negative claims about vaccines in terms of my kid just got sick right after they got vaccinated. That's a big one. And how many scientific studies really are there? Okay. That sounds less like science the more I think about it. And the supervolcanoes, I got a problem with that one as well. I mean, I just can't imagine what it would be that could trigger it. I mean, I know for some supervolcanoes, they've detected a pattern of eruptions every certain amount of years, which would kind of lead you to think that it is the slow buildup over time. But that doesn't mean there couldn't also be some sort of pattern to the external triggers. Yeah, all right, I'm going to go with the anti-vaccine one, fiction.
All right.
Okay, Kara.
I did not know there was a difference between a volcano and a supervolcano.
Whoa.
So,
Yellowstone.
Sure.
Supervolcano.
Maybe there's something external that's necessary because they're so big. I don't know. You guys have both gone with the anti-vaccine one. 2/3 of them use scientific studies to support their negative claims about vaccines. 1/3 use anecdotes. The thing that sounds off to that is that I would agree that probably 2/3 use scientific studies to support their negative claims about vaccines. And I would think that probably almost all of them use anecdotes. So maybe that 1/3 measurement is low because, of course, those are not overlapping, as you explained. But I'm kind of, I don't know, there's something about the ISS medication that's sticking in my craw a little bit. I'm sure that some people take anxiolytics. You know, some people deal with clinical anxiety, and I'm sure that some astronauts do. Although, historically, we had that, you know, NASA right stuff bullshit mandate where people had to be like psychologically pure or something like that to be able to go to space, which to me is crazy because that just means that they're like not that human. But I think that is starting to change. I wouldn't be surprised, though, if that is a holdover. And also a lot of people on the ISS are not American. They're Russian. And I would really not be surprised if cosmonauts still have that right stuff mentality that if you take psychiatric medication that you're not even allowed to go into space. Something tells me that the most of the medication on these missions is actually anti-nausea medication, but I could be wrong. So there's that's bugging me, but also one third of anti-vax websites using anecdotes is bugging me. So I really feel strongly that it's one of those two. But just to go a little against the grain, I'm going to say that the anti-anxiety medication on the ISS is the fiction.
And Jay.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Kara on that. I don't think that any space agency that's legit is going to put anybody up in space that has any amount of anxiety that needs to be medicated. These people need to be razor sharp, and they can't have their emotions getting in the way and having, you know, out of control emotions like anxiety getting in the way at all. And they test the hell out of them.
Yeah, but going to space does induce anxiety. Just saying.
Yeah, that I mean, bottom like, line is there are people. There's quite a few people out there that have the brass balls to do things like this, and they don't feel anxiety like normal people do. You know, Steve, as an example, is one of those people that just does not have, in my opinion, a normal spectrum of anxiety. He has a very, very low, almost zero sense of anxiety. Hmm. There are people out there. There's plenty of people out there. They don't need to pick people that have anxiety problems. I don't think that's even on the menu at all. So I agree. The other two, very briefly, the volcano, I don't know enough about it to speak intelligently, but definitely the anti-vax one. Sure, why not? I think it's fine. Two-thirds of them use scientific studies. They're probably misreading the studies. That's it. I'm with Kara.
So we had a split. Jay and Kara for number two, Bob and Evan for number one. So you all agree with the third one. A new study suggests that supervolcanoes, unlike regular volcanoes, do not erupt because of a buildup of pressure in their magma chambers and therefore require an external trigger. You all think this one is science.
That's right.
And one is science.
So what is
no
it?
No sweep.
What's the trigger?
Is it is
it buffalo running?
They don't know. So
they don't know?
Oh, they don't know?
All right. The question is, could the mechanisms that we know cause regular volcanoes to erupt, would they cause a supervolcano to erupt? And there's some disagreement about this, but the most recent study modeled the pressures, the physics of the magma in the magma chamber, and they found that there would not be enough force to cause it to erupt simply because of the pressure in the chamber itself. In their model, the chamber doesn't really build a lot of pressure. The previous hypothesis was that because magma is lighter than the rock above it, that there's a buoyancy pressure. You know, it would want to float upward. And
yeah,
so they
and
modeled
what's
that.
What's above it?
They modeled it, and they found that even if you take an unlikely scenario of differences in density, you still make negligible pressure in the chamber. You know, there's negligible pressure upward. So this was a study that was done by Patricia Gregg out of the University of Illinois. And she said that the prevailing hypothesis for how eruptions are triggered says we don't see a lot of evidence for pressurization. So something else must be going on. Essentially, they're saying that the trigger's got to come from above. The vault over the magma chamber has to collapse because of an earthquake, for example. So an earthquake might be a trigger. I was thinking an asteroid impact, which is interesting because recently there's been some discussion about the impact that killed off the dinosaurs may have also triggered supervolcanoes in Asia, right?
Oh, wow. Right. Like multiple supervolcanoes.
Yeah. So there might have been a double tap, you know, a double hit. Impact followed by triggering supervolcanoes. Mm. Now, regular volcanoes, that's what happens. Pressure builds up in the magma chamber and then it blows its top. But the same dynamics just don't exist for these super volcanoes, which could be 500 times the size of a regular volcano.
That's like, actually good news.
I guess so.
I guess so.
Yeah. It's good news because it doesn't treat, if it's an asteroid, it doesn't treat an asteroid impact and a super volcano as two discrete events. If you're going to get hit by an asteroid, so what? Throw a little super volcano in there as well. You're already getting hit.
Right. But they're saying it could be an earthquake. So, for example, a seismic activity could cause a crack to open up from the surface down to the magma chamber. That will force the fluid up through the crack, And right. then, which could unzip, they use the term unzip the whole thing, and then boom, you get a super volcano eruption.
Unzip. Yeah. That's interesting.
My takeaway from this was that we don't understand this well enough at this point in time. The prevailing theory was essentially contradicted by this modeling that they did, this evaluation, and therefore we need to figure out more about how what does trigger them to erupt. Obviously, that might improve our ability to predict their eruptions, which would be kind of important. You know, a supervolcano could be an extinction event.
Yeah.
You know, they're rare, massive things, and they could totally disrupt the climate. They can cause lots of problems. So you guys are all safe so far. So yes. What should I do? Should I go to number one or number two?
Well, let's stop here then.
Let me go. I guess we'll just go in reverse order. So we'll go to number two. A large survey of anti-vaccine websites finds that 2/3 of them use scientific studies to support their negative claims about vaccines, while 1/3 use anecdotes. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Kara think this one is science. And this one is science.
Yeah!
All right!
So, yeah, this is a survey of hundreds of anti-vaccine websites. They said nearly 500 websites they reviewed.
Wow.
That the most of the websites, 2/3, linked to either bad studies or misinterpreted studies, presented them as if they were a reliable science in order to support their claims that vaccines cause autism or are harmful or cause neurological injury or whatever. They're basically using pseudoscience in order to support their claims. And I was very surprised that only 1/3 of them backed them up also with anecdotes.
Yeah, that seemed fishy to me, but I don't know.
Yeah, but that's what they found. You know, it's a pretty straightforward survey. So, and part of the point that they're making is, you know, we have to learn how to talk to parents about vaccine issues. The thing is, the websites that they're going to are pretending to have scientific evidence to back up their positions. And that could be very difficult, you know, for as a public education or public health measure, because people may not be able to tell the difference between a legitimate reference to scientific evidence and a bogus one. So it could lend a patina of legitimacy to these horrible anti-vaccine websites.
You know, the only thing that really matters here is that Kara and I beat Bob and Evan.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, wait, is my mic on?
It was fun.
But I'm interested to see what the medication is.
Yeah, so an examination of the medications used by astronauts on long-duration missions aboard the ISS finds that the most common medications used are for anxiety. That is the fiction. So there was a review of, because the crew members on the ISS have to record everything they do, including every medication they take. So they reviewed medication records from 24 crew members on 20 missions longer than 30 days over a 10-year period. And what did they find? What were the most common indications for medication?
It's got to either be like aspirin or anti-nausea.
Sleeping.
Yeah, but Evan is correct. Evan is correct. Sleep.
It was shit, for sleep. Of course sleeping.
Because it's really hard to sleep in zero gravity. It's hard
to get
comfortable.
Thought about it afterwards.
Yeah, so sleep problems was number one. Pain was number two, so there's your aspirin.
It's my aspirin.
Nasal congestion, number three, or allergy. Anxiety wasn't even on the list. There was zero mention of anxiety. I made that up for the reasons that you said, Jay, because there was a reason to think that it was implausible. They also found that there were a lot of skin rashes.
The ISS be dirty.
Dry.
Rubbing up against Velcro all day.
It's dirty in there. It's gross.
It's dirty. It's cramped. They're in clothes all the time. Yeah, you know, so spacesuits and whatnot. So, yeah, that's an issue as well.
Bacterial clouds.
But no anti-nausea?
They didn't mention it. They didn't
mention
it.
I remember when I interviewed two astronauts while they were on the ISS. It was like my crowning achievement.
Wow,
and I
did it
in the first week of my job when I worked at HuffPost. Yeah, and it was so cool. And I got to, and they were like floating around, like looking at me, and I'm interviewing them. And I asked them a bunch of sourced questions from readers. And one of them was, what do you do if you have to barf in space? And they were like, you just swallow it.
Yeah, because if Rusty Swikert, when we interviewed him, said when you're on an EVA, when you're in a spacesuit in zero gravity,
gosh.
If you throw up, you die.
You die.
Yeah.
That's it.
You
if
die
you're in a spacesuit in the space station. It's not as bad, but still, you don't want vomit floating around. Yeah.
Yeah, they were like, all of your crewmates will kill you.
Yeah.
Like you will clog up everything with your puke, and they were like, it is not worth it. Just swallow it.
They don't have a thing that you could puke into that keeps it
sequestered. They probably do have like bags that they can do, but I'm not sure if it's even worth that.
A vomitorium.
Yeah. And I would only imagine people would get pretty sick, at least when they first get up there. Because also I heard that the smell is unbearable when you first walk in.
What? Really?
They don't have Febreze up there?
Think about it. Every skin flake that ever fell off of a human being in the ISS is still floating around in the ISS.
You would think they would have really good filtration systems.
I think they do. But it's still, it's like being on an airplane for years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's still pretty gross.
And the airplane can draw in air from the outside, and they can't.
It's not that sexy when you're there, I guess.
No, I hear it's really stifling and gross. So, but
that's interesting to think about that. That, you know, I imagine that, you know, at some future time, let's imagine 100 years from now, when there is a self-sustaining station on the moon or on Mars, there's things about that we will not have fully anticipated, you know, like maybe it just smells awful.
Yeah.
All the time, and there's nothing you could do about it. It's just there might be some facts of life, you know, living on a station.
Space madness. Yeah, that just slowly.
No science fiction writer has ever anticipated.
Like the creature comforts we're so used to that you don't think about. Like when people have anosmia, we talked about anosmia being one of those words. What's the word? When people have anosmia, they're like, I never understood how much my sense of smell meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's little things like that we just take for granted.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so good job, Jay and Kara.
Yay.
Why, thank you, sir.
What do we win? Oh, it doesn't work that way.
Lightsabers. My respect.
Lightsabers.
And lightsabers. Yeah. Awesome.
All right, Evan, give us the quote.
Science has proof without any certainty. Creationists have certainty without any proof. Spoken by anthropologist Ashley Montague. American anthropologist who popularized the study of topics such as race and gender and their relationship to politics and development. He authored over 60 books throughout his lifetime. And in 1995, the American Humanist Association named him Humanist of the Year.
Yeah, that's a really good quote. I've heard that quote in other versions, though.
Me
know,
too, yeah.
The whole certainty without proof, proof without certainty. That's certainly applicable. You could, you could generalize it to pseudoscience, you know, and to belief systems, ideology. Yeah, it's not specific to creationism.
Right, right. Just thought it was interesting. A specialist on race and gender happened to mention creationism at some point. I thought that was
That's an issue, by the way. Absurd. We're not going to get into it on this episode. I'm just going to put this bug in your ear for a future episode. The whole question of whether or not race is real, I find fascinating. And I we needed to do a deep dive on that at some point.
That'd be fascinating.
Montague published a series of works questioning the validity of race as a biological concept.
Yeah, which is it's legitimate to question it, but I think again, I don't want to do a drive by. We need to do a deep dive on that.
That's a very
deep dive. We're going to talk about it at all,
or bring a specialist in to help us.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely,
thanks, Doctor.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.